You're listening live to the 12th episode of the Armand and Akil Show, bringing you interviews with local activists, politicians, and policy experts from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. I'm Armand Rana.
And I'm Akil Krishnan. It's Saturday, the 27th of January at 5.09 p.m. We are broadcasting live from UBC's Vancouver campus on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hunkminam-speaking Musqueam people.
It's been a while, Akil. When was our last episode again?
So our last episode was on the 4th of November. It's been a minute since then.
Nothing's happened since then, right?
Obviously nothing at all. The world has been exactly static. Nothing's moved. There's been no New Year's. But I'm very excited for our episode today.
Yeah, so what's happening in today's episode?
So on today's episode, we have an amazing guest with us in the studio. We have former city councillor and current adjunct professor of practice at UBC School of Public Policy and Global Affairs and instructor at SFU. We have Andrea Reimer with us on the show. Welcome, Andrea. How are you doing today?
I'm great. Thanks so much for the warm welcome.
Yeah, thanks so much for coming here. Could you start off by just telling us a bit more about yourself and your current role at UBC? And SFU and your consultancy and political work?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I guess I'd start by saying if I had to do my whole life over again, I might have chosen to do a few less things because I find it a little challenging to summarize in this kind of context. But I'll do
that's
my
a good,
best.
That's a good problem to have, though.
Yeah, that's the purpose of choosing what to do in life is to summarize them on podcasts.
Yeah. Well, so a friend of mine sent a meme. I'm a Sagittarius. I just had my birthday in December. And it's basically it's a picture of a woman and it says, I'm in the mood to F something up today. And that is essentially the attitude of Sagittarians. Why you end up doing all these things with your life, right? Is you keep trying to find a new way to sort of, or in my case, a new way to transform change. I teach here at UBC. I'm an adjunct professor of practice at the School of Public Policy and Global Affairs. I teach two things there. A power literacy course that I developed, which I'll talk about, I can explain a bit more. And then also I support the practicum for the second year students in the Masters of Public Policy and Global Affairs. The professor of practice part is because I didn't go to university, so therefore do not have the academic background that like a professor might have. And so awesome that the university here and others across the country are really looking at this question of how do you merge practice and theory. So that's my job is to try and help students translate that theory into practice. So that's how I came to teach power literacy as I spent quite a bit of time in local government, 4 terms, 1 on the school board and 3 on city council, and spent time in the regional government, was involved in provincial and national politics and policy making, and internationally at the UN to push forward climate action. And before that, I was a community organizer. I ran a large environmental nonprofit and volunteered on objectively probably too many boards for social justice and community economic development and governance reform organizations. And before that, I lived on the streets for a little over a decade. And I would say in all of those different, from being at the United Nations to being at a city council meeting to trying to push policies forward and being on the streets, what I saw over and over again is that the people who had power completely misused their power. And that the people who perceived themselves as not having power actually had a fair bit, but because they didn't, they were either, they had an anti-power bias because they see power holders abusing power and they're like, whoa, I don't want to be like that. So I'm not gonna attach this word power to myself. Or they just simply don't have the mentorship and experience to kind of feel confident in their power and then have pathways to use it. So it's how I came to teach power literacy. And I'm really passionate about it. I just developed a version. I do trainings with organizations and elected officials on it, and I just developed a self-paced course online so that people have more access to it.
So just to clarify, super interesting. Like power literacy, is that like basically making people be aware of the power that they do have? Is that the purpose of it? Or
yeah, I mean, I'll be straight up. It's kind of a term I made up. I haven't seen it anywhere else, although would love to. And I guess like when I first started thinking about how to teach it, one thing I kind of left out that I'll just throw in right now, in between this all, when I decided to leave city council in 2018, a good friend and mentor who works here at UBC, Maura Coyle. She's in the provost's office. She really encouraged me to apply for a fellowship at Harvard. And so you can see my face and that I'm laughing. And so this is so funny, right, that some street kid with a high school education would apply to Harvard and somehow get a paid fellowship. And I was like, okay, Maura, like, I'll humor you and do this. But I don't think it's going to come to pass. And then it did. So then I found myself, I mean, you can't say no to Harvard. I hadn't actually really imagined that what it would be like to accept it, because I just assumed it was impossible, right? Which I think is such a good lesson in life, that the things, like, this goes back to power. We limit ourselves from doing things, and then they don't happen, right? And that's not to say just because you apply, you're going to get in, because a whole bunch of other people didn't. And I could have been in that position too. But it did give me this opportunity to spend a year, a paid year, in what I refer to as intellectual Disneyland, because unlike students, I had all the access to all these incredible people and learning opportunities, and none of the stress or pressure of having to get assignments done and those types of things. So it really gave me the chance to think about and then also go talk to some world leading thinkers on issues of democracy. Trump was president at the time, so I'm there, like, kind of in the intellectual capital of the U.S. Often went to New York, which is about a 4-hour train ride from Boston, so got to spend time there. Washington, D.C., another 4-hour, like 8 hours from Boston. So got to spend all this time in these key parts of America at a very difficult time in its history, and really think about the democratic decline I'd seen myself in city council. I mean, it's hard to equate those scales, and they were definitely different, but had seen some erosion at city council and have seen an acceleration of that over the last few years. But to say, like, I was like, what's going wrong here, right? And from my perspective, it would be weird if there were one answer and I happened to know it and no one else did, and I don't want to suggest that. But for what I could perceive from this perspective of having been very outside of power and then inside of power, was this issue of power literacy, and something I could contribute to, right, was to try and have people develop it. So I started developing this course at Harvard and got to beta test it there with some students. And I realized, like, we don't even have, like, an alphabet to talk about power, right? Like, there's just basic ideas, like different kinds of power. Nobody talks to us about that. In fact, if you were a child and you said, Mom, I think, like, Auntie whoever is more powerful than your, like, my uncle, they'd be like, what are you talking about?
Like, yeah, what's a framework for us to even, like, go about approaching? Like, what does that even mean? Like, where did these things fit in with respect to each other?
Yeah, well, and I think we do talk about it, but we use surrogates to talk about it, right? So we talk about money. Like, when we go to a party, we might ask someone what they do for a living. And so maybe you say you're a student, right? And people are like, oh, that's nice, like, or whatever, right? But if you said, I'm a student at Harvard, suddenly they're like, oh, well, that's interesting. I, like, personally experienced this, right? And then I'd be like, yeah, I'm a student at Harvard on a fellowship. And then they'd be like, oh, okay. And, like, tell me more, right? So what they're really saying is, oh, your power, I'm now perceiving you to have more and more power, and I want to attach that power. I observed it when I was on city council. The title of city councilor carried power. And then I became the city's first deputy mayor. And suddenly that carried, like, a whole other thing about access. And through all of this, I was the same person who was living outside on the streets as well. Like, it wasn't that I became some different person, right? So, and yet that is a low power position. And so nobody wants to talk to you about anything, right? And so trying to figure out how do we develop the skills and the literacy we need to understand our own power, to understand other people's power. And then, you know, my big hope is that collectively we're able to build power. But that's not possible if we can't even talk about it, because there's no language to do that.
Makes sense.
Well, you know, one of the things that we really like to, and you touched upon this already, one of the things we really like to do on this podcast is to understand like the people behind the policies, you know, their life stories and how it shaped them and how it shapes their approach to problems or to policy. You were born in Saskatchewan. Could you share a little bit about, you know, what made you what led you to Vancouver and what made you stay in this city?
Yeah,
and make it home.
I often joke about this that I'm a fifth generation Vancouverite, born in Saskatchewan, because I was adopted. So I was born to what I will call my birth family in Saskatchewan, was put into foster care and then subsequently adopted by a family that was living in Saskatoon at the time, but have their roots here in Vancouver. And so this was kind of home as much as I understood home to be anywhere. My parents, my adopted parents, they moved around a fair bit. And so I sort of perceived this much larger adopted family I had in Vancouver. I have a lot of aunts and uncles and cousins with kids and, yeah, many people living here in Vancouver, or the Lower Mainland is probably a better way of saying that. And so when I settled down is such a weird word to attach to myself, because I think nobody would perceive me necessarily as settled or down. But I've lived here now for many years, continuously since the early, like late 80s, early 90s. Yeah.
And, at some stage, I think we're skipping ahead a bit, but at some stage you became leader of the Vancouver Green Party and, you know, eventually on the school board. So what was that, you know, journey like for you? Like, how did you get to that point in life?
Well, there's like this quite, I guess, cute and somewhat over talked about story in my family, and from my perspective at least, about the protests I used to arrange in preschool if I perceived an injustice, or in a particular case, I've always hated raisins and they only had raisins for snacks. So I organized a whole, it's very funny now that I have a kid, I can't imagine how this worked, but I organized a nap in where we would just not get up from napping, right? So any parents listening to this are like, why would that be a problem, right? A group of kids sleeping for an extra long period of time. But I think the idea that we could organize scared the folks that were looking after us enough that they're like, huh, before this gets more intense, maybe we should get something other than raisins. And so I learned pretty early. And my parents, they were quite low income, like what I think you would refer to as working class. And they, like, the way things worked was because they worked together, right? So my mom worked and other people looked after us. And then when my mom wasn't working, she'd look after other people's kids, right? I'm pretty sure I was like double digits by the time I got my first new pair of pants, because we'd just pass everything down, right? I had an older brother and he'd get clothes from other people's families. And that wasn't a shameful or stigma thing. It was just how things worked, right? And so I think I observed from a very, very young age that when people work together, they can do much more than they can get done alone. I don't even think I had a concept of what people doing things alone look like until I was much older, because that's not how things worked in the communities where I was. So I think I've always had a pretty keen sense of that. And, you know, I ran for student council when I was in school. I tried to organize people when I saw, the kinds of issues when I was growing up were things like trying to organize against nuclear war and nuclear non-proliferation treaties.
So what years would this be? This would be like the
80s. Yeah.
The 80s.
Yeah. The 80s were where I, a lot of anti-poverty work, yeah. For sure, because I saw that. And then when I left home, was a very live issue that I was seeing myself dealing with, but a lot of friends. And I just always saw, I think my parents' influence, for sure, they're not political by any stretch. In fact, the joke was always like they could probably handle the drugs and the sex work, but the idea that I'd get up on stage in front of a microphone, they're like, that is not our kid, right? Because it just was so far out of the experiences that they had. But I mean, they were both, my father's passed on now, my mom's still alive, but I'm it's not to say they weren't proud of me, right? Because they also fought against injustice in their own way, in a different way, but an important way. In the 90s, like early 90s, I was first able to vote in the 1991 provincial election. And so I was, you know, getting petitions signed with people against all sorts of terrible, I don't even know if most of the people listening would even know what this is, but there was a political party called the Socreds. They're sort of, so the BC Liberals / United are another iteration of the Socreds. And so we were fighting against policies the Socreds had that were quite damaging to people who needed social assistance and government support. And we're organizing to get better things happening. And so I'm like, well, so let's get involved in this election. And it was like the moment where the needle on the record just is like, arch, and everyone's like, why would we do that? And I'm like, why wouldn't we do that, right? Like, we can either convince, I mean, I think what I would have thought of at the time is like bad people, and I'm air quoting that because I have a more nuanced approach to the world now, have seen that it's more complicated than that. But we can get people who don't agree with us to agree with us, or we could just elect people who agree with us, right? That seems like a much simpler strategy overall. But nobody wanted to. And it kind of just, it was almost like a very defining moment in my life was that situation where I was like, why don't people see democracy as a vehicle for change, right? Like, it's this thing that's right there. We just have to organize to get it. I learned that it's a bit more complicated than that over the years, but that it's much simpler than the alternative, which is a non-democracy where you never have that opportunity, right? Or choosing not to participate in the electoral process at all and just being at the whims of it, right?
For sure.
Yeah.
So it seems like there was more, it was like a very natural process of you always wanting to stand up to injustice, and you kind of questioning that throughout, and not, it wasn't like a light bulb went off and like, wow, I can actually make a difference. Which I think for some people, like for me, I've always wanted to speak up against injustice, and for, you know, as a kid too, questioning like, why do I have food every day? And there's kids down the street who don't. But you know, when you go to university, you start questioning certain things, you start thinking in certain ways, and you go, oh, I can actually do something about this. But it seems like it was more like a natural progression of you trying to do that at every step.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Although, interestingly, like in a family of non-political introverts. So the other thing, so my mother, father, and then I have an adopted brother from another family. So the four of us are like genetic strangers, right? Which is weird in the context of a family. And so I definitely was like the black sheep of our family in terms of this political activism. Although, like, my mom now in her 80s and for quite a number of years now, when she wants something done, she calls up her MLA or her MP, right? And is like, I can do this because she's seen someone doing that, right? Someone
Absolutely.
Very close to
yeah.
her. My brother didn't vote for, I feel like I'm totally outing him here, but it took some time for him to see the value in voting. Now he's very engaged in politics, but I think probably more importantly, community organizations and like
for
building
sure.
That capacity, which is equally critical.
And I think that's where most of us have the most power is to do things with community and community building and municipal politics. And I think that's it's interesting to me that that's where I find a lot of awareness is lacking with, I think for people my age, for instance, where there's a lot more, it's easier to kind of understand federal politics because it's ubiquitous and there's news articles and everything. There's so much out there, but there's less awareness of municipal issues. And that's the thing that's closest to you. That's kind of the lowest level. It's the thing that you can impact directly because you live in the area in which that kind of sphere of influence is.
Yeah. And I mean, I started provincial. The issues I was concerned about, social assistance, childcare, healthcare, access to education, transportation, housing, these are all under the Constitution, not universally provincial, but sit pretty squarely in provincial jurisdiction. So I started there. My first election campaign I volunteered on was in 96. I worked on the Green Party's campaign in Nelson Creston, which is a electoral district kind of in the middle of British, in the West Kootenays, like where the city of Nelson is. I think we thought we were going to get our candidate elected with the Green Party in 1996, which got to believe, right? But we
no other way to run an election, though.
Totally. And it was really fun. I learned so much. There's a woman who was the kind of chair of the party or the chair of that electoral district at the time, Colleen McCrory, who has since passed on. But I learned a lot about community-based organizing from her. She was a real towering giant in the world of community organizing. And, you know, I'll say, like, that's actually fairly uncommon in the environmental movement. The environmental movement tends to be more advocates and mobilizers. So they view people as taps that they turn on when they need people to come to a march, and a tap they turn off when they want to do policy research, etc. And this concept of organizing, where you're like legitimately meeting people where they're at and giving them microphones and having them talk about the issues that they're concerned about, is not, it's not common in the environmental movement, right? It's people who believe themselves to be right talking about the things that they're right about, or they believe themselves to be right about,
right,
and having other people join them. And it is, I guess it might be a question you're going to get to, but one of the reasons I left the Green Party was around that I'm an organizer. I believe very strongly in the power of community. I think I'm probably right about some things, but I'm probably wrong about a lot more things. And I think it's a false dichotomy, right? Like, it's the solutions aren't the best solutions that you have. They're the best solutions that you can actually get implemented. And those are the ones that have broad buy-in because you've taken the time to hear people out on what they think the solutions are and how they would interact with them, right?
Absolutely. All right, so at this point, I think we're just going to take a quick break. If you're tuning in, you are listening to the Armand and Akhil Show on CITR 101.9 FM. We're going to take a quick break and be right back with former City Councillor Andrea Reimer. So stick around.
Canadian Arts and Culture Organizations. Student Work Placement Program at the Cultural Human Resources Council is able to provide wage subsidies for post-secondary level students to work for you. A two-minute phone call to confirm your eligibility, 20 minutes to complete the online application, and you'll secure thousands of dollars in less than 2 weeks. If you hired, currently employ, or would like to hire students, we want to hear from you. Find our contact info at culturalhrc.ca.
Chers organismes d'art et de culture au Canada, le programme de placement étudiant du Conseil des ressources humaines du secteur culturel offre encore des subventions salariales. Un appel de 2 minutes, un formulaire en ligne de 20 minutes et vous pourriez recevoir une subvention de quelques 1000 $ en moins de 2 semaines. Si vous avez eu ou si vous prévoyez engager des étudiants de niveau postsecondaire, trouvez-nous sur le web par un moteur de recherche en tapant CRHSC suivi de PPE accent aigu. À bientôt!
Fun Drive 2024 is right around the corner, and this February is the perfect time to say yes to CITR and all it has to offer. Visit donatetocitr.ca right now, make a donation, and then claim your prizes. For a $30 donation, you'll receive a CITR earplug case. $60 gets you a glow-in-the-dark yo-yo. A donation of $101.90 scores you specialized marble dice and a song dedication on Valentine's Day.
The next one's dedicated to Rachel from Ross.
A $200 donation will get you an engagement ring 32-ounce Nalgene water bottle. $500 and you'll be sporting a nifty Just Married sweatsuit. And for a grand donation of $1,000, you'll get to host your own show on CITR 101.9 FM.
Testing, testing. Is this thing on?
And remember, all prize tiers include their specific prizes, plus all the prizes from lesser tiers. That means for an $1,000 donation to CITR, you will receive an earplug case, a glow-in-the-dark yo-yo, marble dice, a Valentine's Day song dedication.
The next one's dedicated to Rachel from Ross.
A 32-ounce Nalgene water bottle, a fashionable Just Married sweatsuit, and of course, your own show on the station.
All right, here we go.
So what are you waiting for? Say yes and visit donatetocitr.ca today and help us reach our goal of $20,000. Hey Vancouver, for fans of Ocean Alley, Flip Turn, and Still Woozy, alt rockers Juice are bringing their signature blend of rock, pop, R&B and hip-hop to the Biltmore Cabaret on February 3rd, with support from Hembree. Tickets are on sale now. Get yours at admitone.com.
MRG Live is happy to present Anomaly with his live band at the Wise Hall on Saturday, February 24th, with support from Blue Wednesday. Anomaly has toured his electro jazz project all over the world, but this February, the Montreal-based artist embarks on a full Canadian tour for the very first time. Come out to experience the innovative fusion of electronic beats, jazz harmonies, and funky grooves from the one and only Anomaly, live in concert with his band. Don't miss Anomaly at the Wise Hall in Vancouver on February 24th, 2024. Tickets are on sale now at admitone.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Armand and Nikhil Show on CITR 101.9 FM. We're talking to Andrea Rima, who's a former city councillor and adjunct professor at UBC and an instructor at SFU. Armand, do you want to take it away?
Yes. So, we were talking earlier about your time in the Green Party. You later joined Vision Vancouver. What was that experience like? You know, you were effectively the leader of the Green Party, and now you're just a member of another party.
Yeah, that's a good question. So we were talking about the provincial politics. So I was a member of the Green Party provincially, originally worked in the 96 election. In 2001, I was part of a five-person team that ran the election. Green Party at that time was very into collective, and so I was part of that collective. And we, you know, so where in 96, we'd got this one riding to go from 2% to 12%. In 2001, we were able to get the whole province vote from, like, we'd been at 1.8% and made up to, I think it was 12.4%. God, it's funny. It was like over 20 years ago, and I can still remember these numbers because they were huge achievements at the time, but obviously not enough to elect someone. And so the other thing that happened in 2001 in that election was that the NDP, who'd been in power for 10 years, lost quite badly, and it was a Liberal, BC Liberal government, 77 members to two. And so, you know, we're at the time a group of us involved in community organizing and progressive social justice, environmental issues. We're like, how do we deal with this? And my feeling was we build power at the local level, like build from the ground up. And so I got involved in the local Green Party in Vancouver Green Party. It's one of those things. Maybe this is advice to people listening. So, like, you know, there's this joke is like you show up at a meeting to like vote on something, and the next thing you know, you're like the fundraiser or the chair, right? In my case, I was the chair. And that was not my intention, but it's how that meeting ended up. And so there I was, like, chairing the Green Party locally, and there was an election coming up that year, 2002 municipal election, and we were. We were negotiating with other parties around space because we'd had a situation very similar to now, this particular point in time in Vancouver, where there were a lot of parties, progressive parties or parties that had policies that could broadly be considered progressive. And they would split the vote and then the right wing party would just clean up, like eat our lunch. Right. And so at that point, in 96, the right wing party won every seat on school, park and city council.
And this was the MPA?
Yeah, it was the MPA. What I would argue is now ABC. The way the Socreds became the Liberals and then BC United, I would argue the NPA became ABC. But so the progressive parties had figured out that they needed to talk and not run against each other if we wanted any chance of winning seats. And so we were in negotiations around that. We had X number of council candidates and park board, and we had no one to run for school. And someone said to me, Andrea, I was chair at the time, and they were like, Andrea, it doesn't really matter because a Green could never win at school board. And I was like, well, actually, I think we could win a school board. As noted, I'd been involved in education politics. At that point, I had a five-year-old in 2002, just entering kindergarten, had strong thoughts about education. And the BC Liberals at the time were eviscerating funding for public education. And the system was really in crisis. And to make sure that it's not one-sided here, the NDP, when they were in power, had also cut education quite badly. So you've sort of seen cuts on top of cuts. So there I ran for school board. We knocked on doors, which at the time the Green Party had never done that before. They viewed knocking on doors as an invasion of people's privacy, just to give you a sense.
That's hilarious.
Yes, it's changed. Well, and we wanted to show my goal had been to show we could do better than we'd done. It had not actually maybe been to elect people, because that seemed like a big jump from where we'd been at 1.8%.
But you know, to at least like push the needle, right?
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah,
I wanted us to have a good, strong showing and learn that these tools of organizing, like going, meeting people where they're at, listening to their concerns about public policy, thinking about how we could best express that in a platform, and then run to represent it was how you build support. Like, that's the point
of an
electoral campaign. And so I, you know, we started a group of three of us, and we started knocking on doors, and we get volunteers, and the volunteers would come and help knock on doors. By the end of the election, we'd knocked on over 20,000 doors. And so it's election night, and remembering I'm the chair of the party, so I'm sort of running two roles, right? And part of my job is expectation management with candidates, to be like, you did so great, like you tripled your vote or you quadrupled it. And so there's 140, at that time, 140 polls in Vancouver. So a poll is like a geographic area that you vote in. Sorry, let me rephrase that. There are 139 in Vancouver, and school board has one more because UBC votes in school board elections, but not mayor and council and park board. And so I had a beer, and you know, the result, because you're waiting, results take a while to come in. And then I had another beer, and we were on like poll 138, and I was in 11th place. You need to be in the top nine to win at school board. And our council candidates were considerably lower, but I was the highest candidate, but I was in 11th place. And nobody, like, you know, when you watch election night, they call it at like 40% of polls reporting. Like,
absolutely.
Nobody comes back from, you don't win on the last two polls. And so then the next poll counts and I jump up to 10th place. And I'm like, there's still no way, you guys. Like, it's great. I was like 1,000 votes out or something. Like, I'm like, there's no way this is going to happen. And so then I order another beer. So like I'm on my fourth beer now and maybe getting a little drunk, but also I'm exhausted and we've had an election. We did a good show. Speeches are done. Let's just move on here. And then I jump up because, you know, the last reporting poll is UBC. So all these students are going to vote for a Green Party candidate. Like a young, I was 29, I think, at the time, like had a bit of a reputation as a loud, determined advocate, let's say, like had some appeal. And I just jumped up and won on the last poll and then had to spend the rest of the night hiding from media because I did not want the first Green elected in Canada to be like this exhausted, drunk, like this incoherent woman. Anyway, so that was funny. But it was a really amazing thing to get elected that first time. And yeah, so how did it feel to leave? You know, I was elected with a party that at the time was called COPE, still exists, but has largely been, the people who were sort of instrumental in that version of COPE kind of went on to do the One City. A lot of them ended up at One City. And we worked great together at school board. It was, I should mention too, I was also the first Green Party person ever endorsed by a union in Canada. So I was endorsed by the Teachers Association, Secondary Teachers, and subsequently the Vancouver District Labor Council on the strength of that secondary teachers. And that made a huge difference too, right? I only won by about 50 votes on 60,000 votes cast. So it was, yeah, every vote definitely counted. So then it was kind of on me to show what a Green could do. The provincial party didn't, not everyone, but certainly the leader at the time and some key people did not view the lesson of my work that we should knock on more doors. And so that was sort of the beginning of my decision to move away from the provincial party. And then we lost the 2005 election campaign because we could not, you know, leadership matters, right? I'd like it not to. I come from an anarchist tradition, like a real anarchist, like political analysis, and I really wanted it not to matter, but it does. And in a civic election, who you run for mayor really matters. And so I and some other people in 2008 were looking for a mayoral candidate that could bring the Greens and, like, Vision at that point had split off, and Cope, and, like, all these people together under one umbrella. And that person turned out to be Gregor Robertson. And so I just, it was hard, and running for Vision, and it was impossible for me to ask people to join a party to support him if I wasn't willing to do that. And most political parties, you can't be a member of them and another political party, and that's a good thing. Like, you should make decisions about these things. Yeah. And so I left the Greens to join Vision. I also made the, I don't know if it was a mistake, I guess history will tell, but I made what I felt at the time was a mistake of saying to Gregor, who'd been a friend for, you know, a decade at that point, we'd both been very involved in climate and environmental issues. I had said to him, whatever you need help with, I was part of the team that recruited him. I co-chaired his nomination campaign. And I said, anything you need, just let me know. So it turned out what he needed was me to run for city council, which hadn't really been part of the plan, but whatever. So then I ended up spending three terms on council.
That's actually what something that I wanted to touch up on is during your time as city council as a member of Vision, you championed the Greenest City 2020 action plan. And this is something that I did hear a lot about in 2014, like when I first, as a newcomer to Canada. And I just wanted, you know, your thoughts on, like, how would you reflect on the success of that plan? About, let's say, 10 years on from at least one of the, from a key point in the development of that plan.
Yeah, no, it was huge. Like, it was huge at a number of levels. In 2008, when we were elected, the economy was crashing out and Obama had just been elected. And also there was the subprime mortgage crisis and the subsequently banks failing and all that. And, you know, generally a mood of a lot of pessimism, and this idea that being the greenest city in the world and ending homelessness and building a world-class economy, like these goals we were elected on, people were like, why would we want to do that? Like, what if we just sort of hunker down and survive, right? And we just wouldn't let go of it. It's like, if we can't, this is something I've heard my whole life, right? From the right wing, I hear, and progressive as well. We'll do it later, right? Like, we'll solve climate when the economy's doing better, or the economy's doing too well, we can't solve climate now, right? Or homelessness, same thing, right? Like, and so I think doing Greenest City, there was a few things that it did. I mean, it was hugely successful at moving policies and just totally restructuring the DNA of how a city operates, but it also showed people, I mean, I think the thing I said all the time to people was, like, governments have, like, 18 ministries screwing things up and one trying to fix it all, right? The environment ministry in this case.
For sure.
Cities, the same thing. You've got all these departments screwing things up, and then you're supposed to have an office of sustainability that tries to put it, like, Humpty Dumpty back together.
Absolutely.
Again, right? It's just a dumb strategy, right? Like, have a set of overarching goals that you're all pushing towards. And so that every department, regardless of who it is or what it's doing, has a sense of, here's where we're going over the next 10 years, here's how I connect to that, and here's what I can do to mobilize that. And so Greenest City kind of, it was the goals that it articulated and the targets, but it was the way it did it that allowed everybody to be part of it, including, like, city departments, but also external partners. We had hundreds of external partners, including UBC, and still have deep partnerships there. We had thousands, tens of thousands of people. It was still the single largest engagement exercise the city has ever done, one of the largest in Canadian history. Our opponents, actually, so we started building this in 2008, and it all finally came to council in 2011. I mean, we had another thing called Quick Starts, thanks God, which was another innovation so that we didn't have to wait for this giant policy. We could kind of act and plan at the same time, which was another big innovation of it. And so we had, like, 35,000 people involved in the engagement, about 5% of Vancouver's residents. We had people, over 500 people in direct advisory roles in these committees that often met like every couple weeks or every month, all engaged in these 10 different areas. And those people represented over 750,000 people living in the Lower Mainland through their memberships and et cetera. And so then our opponents in 2011 ran against this plan, which is functionally like running against this, the people of the city of Vancouver, right? Like, I'm like, you could hit us on a bunch of stuff, but I would not go after this.
This seems
plan.
Like a silly strategy to, like, to yeah. pursue.
Especially given, you know, the voting system, because like a lot of councillors are probably elected with less than 5% of the
exactly. the vote. Like, it was such a crazy idea. They took the one thing that was the true, like going back to organizing, we told people, if you can get 10 people together, and again, maybe I might have done it differently if I had to do it again. But if you can get 10 people together anywhere in the city, the mayor, myself, or a senior member of staff will come and hear your ideas about Greenest City. Like, we really built it on that organizing ethos, that it had to reflect the wishes of the people of Vancouver. We didn't compromise on the goals. The goals were the highest, met or exceeded the highest standard of any city on earth at the time. We did, so like, you know, the emissions reductions targets were going to be the highest in the world, but we did allow people, in fact, not just allow, invited people in, really like tried to bring people in however we could to talk about how we're going to do that, right? The things, like if I had to point to what didn't work about it, I remember very well the day I realized that we had talked about being the greenest city in the world, and embedded in that was a belief that that, which an unspoken belief that that therefore would make us sustainable. Well, it doesn't, because there is no sustainable city, right? So if you are the greenest, you're just doing less bad than all the others, right?
You may be more sustainable than others, but you're not sustainable as like an absolute state of being.
Exactly. Yeah. And that we really like, so that was a big, and that's when we started like shifting towards, okay, so what, like, we didn't drop the greenest city goals, but really starting to look at, okay, so we have to be fossil fuel free by this date. We have to get like get rid of the worst plastics through the single use strategy and go towards zero waste and circular economy, and really trying to restructure. I think of it like a paper folding exercise. So I'll talk a bit about recycling for that. So if you cut your recycling in half and you fold the paper in half, so now you're at 50%. So you're going to cut it down to 75. So now you're going to fold the paper again. So if you're folding the paper, you all know there's a point where you can't fold it in half anymore and it just springs open again. And I realized most of our green work was focused on that strategy, right? And that what we needed to do was, instead of keeping having the recycling, we had to like rethink this as a circular economy, as one example, right? Like,
for
how
sure.
you're
yeah.
recovering materials all the way through the cycle. And so everything started moving in that direction, which I think has been positive. And this concept of how to make policy and how to engage the public really became kind of the gold standard, not just in Vancouver for subsequent policies, but across the country. And that has served Canadians well. It's not universal, but I think it just really changed. It was like a generational shift, right? It went from a
for
very
sure.
old school approach
yeah.
to a newer one.
And there's something to be said about, even if it isn't tangible, the intangible benefit of actually leading by example and just setting these are a set of standards we can have. These are some things that we should probably pursue for going forward as a city can do. On kind of the topic of being in a city and one of the bigger issues in this city is definitely housing. As everyone who's ever lived in Vancouver, well, most people who lived in Vancouver are aware. A lot of people, I'd say some people, blame this era of Vision Vancouver as contributing to the housing crisis that we have today. Do you think that's fair? What do you think municipal government could have done at that time to mitigate the housing crisis?
Yeah, well, I mean, what we could have done, we were doing. So, I mean, is it fair? I mean, I think how people feel is always valid, right? I mean, it's not for me to decide how people should feel in any situation. I think from my perspective, what I saw was that in 2008, people like me who were renters, I'm a lifelong renter, we were already feeling the housing crisis in 2008. The homeless population of Vancouver between 2002 and 2008 increased by about 600%. So that was as a direct result of the Liberal government's policies at the time in terms of cutting people off welfare, getting rid of rent caps, closing down rental tenancy offices so that people couldn't fight back against evictions. And so you saw this massive increase in homelessness, which was hitting the very lowest income. And then people like me who were, you know, working class, I guess is also what I would describe myself of at the time. We were just barely hanging on. I was getting, I mean, I got evicted over and over again, but at least could go find, and not like just not for cause, but like rent evictions or, you know, the old, my family's moving in, and then you go by and, hey, wait, there's a whole bunch of new renters paying three times what you were paying, right? So I think the crisis has been there for a long time, and but it was people without power or who don't perceive themselves as having power who were experiencing it. And then that waterline kept rising, right? And so when we got elected in 2008, we were trying to get people's attention around homelessness and being like, it's been rising like by this huge amount every year. We managed to get it down to rising at the rate of population in Vancouver. So the population increases about 4% a year and homelessness was increasing about 4% a year. Is that a success? Well, no, because we couldn't get it down from this huge rise it had gone through. We stabilized it. But yeah, it was a very challenging time. And unlike the times we're in now, there was no federal or provincial money. We had a right-wing provincial government. Stephen Harper was prime minister. There was no money there for housing. And so we could only use city tools. Well, city tools are property tax. So you have to raise everyone's housing costs in order to build housing.
Address housing costs.
Yeah, which is a very zero-sum game. And so it was a very stressful and difficult time. But I think one of the things that, you know, we could do was raise people's awareness and interest. And I cannot tell you how many people told me through many years, the city's job isn't to solve the housing crisis. I believe and still think, I mean, one of the political criticisms I've heard about vision is that we raise people's expectation that we could do something about it when we really couldn't. And maybe that's a fair criticism. If we hadn't have done that, I don't think the province or the federal government would be in it now. Like, people would just be starting to, like, get through the noise. I mean, we were screaming very loudly about this crisis and the need for them to get involved, and it still took another, like, number of 4 or 5 years for them to get really engaged in funding housing with the much bigger fiscal tools they have. But I feel what we were able to do, I mean, we're the first city in the world to be able to regulate Airbnb effectively. We're the first city in Canada for the empty homes tax, and we fought hard for that. We built like tens of thousands of rental units that otherwise wouldn't have been built. Some of those had rental controls, others didn't, because the city's ability to put in rental controls is fairly low. But compared to the decade before us, when like less than 1,000 rentals were built, it felt like we were at least able to get some things moving. We had the first renters advisory committee, we think, in the world. We weren't able to find another one. And that made a big difference. We finally got a housing strategy done, which hadn't been done in many years. We got annual homelessness counts, which unfortunately seem to have been abandoned now, but played a big role in us making the case to the province and the federal. Temporary modular, got 1,000 of those, which the current city government has decided to start to leave empty. So, I mean, I could go on, but
yeah, for sure.
So, speaking of the, you know, the current city government, and, you know, kind of paradoxically, you know, housing was not really the forefront of their campaign to some degree. One of the key issues that Mayor Kinsem did campaign on was crime and perceptions of crime. He pledged to hire, you know, 100 additional police officers and mental health nurses. What are your thoughts on this approach to tackling crime and, you know, the other challenges in Vancouver?
Yeah, I mean, I think I've been fairly public about it. And through my time on city council, would not vote for an increase in sworn officers in Vancouver. And when it did finally come at the end of my term, I voted against it. And from my understanding, was the first councillor in quite a few decades to vote against a police request for increased officers. So it is a fairly rare thing. So yeah, I think I'm pretty on the record as being that that's not increasing the number of sworn officers does not increase the safety for most residents. There are situations where I think having more police officers probably does increase safety in that moment, but that the vast majority of people who live without safety in our community, their lives are made less safe by increased surveillance and criminalization of poverty. And that, to me, is the real issue. If you were addressing poverty, you would not have to deal with a lot of the impacts of not addressing it.
For sure. As like as opposed to addressing what seem to be the symptoms of poverty, you know, trying to address poverty itself and the root causes of it. Absolutely.
Yeah. And we've seen that. I mean, this sweep thing is just, it is criminal. That I can't imagine a single version of the future where we do not indict a society that is engaged in the activities that are going on right now in terms of on the coldest days of the year, taking people's their only means of survival. And it's just going to make me more emotional than I already am to get into it too far. But I think people listening probably are very aware of what's going on. There's no version of that action that leads to the people that are being targeted, harassed, abused. It's systemic violence against them. There's no version that they are safe in that. No. And there's no version where the people that I think the mayor thinks he's protecting from them are more safe either, right? Like it's just, and we're all much poorer as a society for having engaged in an activity that just lacks any kind of moral. Yeah, again, the future will not look kindly back on this. The present is not looking kindly on
Absolutely.
It. So I think
yeah.
the future will be like, what were they even thinking?
And
how do we move forward in a better way?
So that's I think it'll be a scathing indictment of us considering ourselves to be a civic society,
yeah.
a just society. And when we do this to the most vulnerable people amongst us. I would love to continue this conversation for hours more. Andrea, you are an amazing guest. Unfortunately, we are at the end of the show. I just want to say a couple of things before we wrap up. Thank you so much for being on the show today. It was an incredible opportunity to have this conversation with you. I know there was a lot more that we'd like to discuss, but we're unfortunately out of time. A few other things to wrap up here. You can find us at The Irmán Akil on Instagram and Twitter, so check us out there.
Yeah, and we do have some awesome shows with a set of guests lined up for you. Do continue to listen and subscribe. You can find all of our episodes on your favorite podcast feed, so do check them out.
Thank you very much for joining us today, and I hope you have a great evening.
MRG Live is...